Jackson. Stan Bonnet is going to be at Waterloo on Thursday next week, 8 days from now, giving a talk in the afternoon. There was a proposal to reschedule my lecture from Thursday afternoon to Friday afternoon, so I wanted to check, is everybody okay with that? Don't see any complaints. Checking with Jason in the back, is the room actually free at that point? Great. All right, so based on email response and response here, I would say things are now rescheduled, and I will put an announcement on the webpage just in case anybody needs it there, but plan on Friday morning and Friday afternoon instead of Thursday afternoon and Friday morning next week. This week, of course, we've got the complete lecture schedule. Let's see. On the computer, was going to fire up. Let's see if this works. Pictures. What these pictures are will be discussed later. And they're not the best pictures in the world, but, well. It will all be discussed at some point. So, what am I talking about today? Yeah, the one thing that I left out of StreamCypher Day was StreamCypher design. What I want you to come out of today feeling like is StreamCypher design is easy. There's a few basic things to watch out for. There's a few issues which might get you into trouble and where there's some current dispute, but basically it's easy to design a StreamCypher. Let me start from mathematics. If you listen to people writing essays about what mathematicians do, they invariably feel the need to distance themselves from the notion of mathematics as being definition, conjecture, theorem, proof, definition, conjecture, theorem, proof, what you find written in papers. People will say things like, mathematics is the search for pattern. What's hidden behind the papers is that mathematicians are making all sorts of tables, doing computer experiments, trying to find relations between objects, and when they succeed in finding such relations, then they try to prove them. The definitions are statements, names for the patterns that we find, and the conjectures are statements of the patterns we think we've found, and theorems and proofs are confidence-building techniques so other people can rely on those patterns that we've found. But basically, mathematics is the search for pattern. And, of course, the mathematical literature is full of all sorts of fascinating patterns, thousands and thousands, probably hundreds of thousands of papers all successfully saying, patterns, here's a pattern in something. For example, if you're working over some finite field FP, actually, I guess with what I say, P doesn't have to be prime, over some finite field, if you multiply together all of the different X minus R's, where R is an element of FP, then you get amazing cancellation, an X to the P minus X, Fermat's little theorem. And this has a wonderful consequence for computation. If you compute the greatest common divisor of a function f in one variable, x, a polynomial in one variable, with x to the p minus x, then that is exactly the greatest common divisor of f of x with the product of x minus 0, x minus 1, all the distinct roots, all the distinct elements of fp. In other words, this is the product over all of the roots of f of r equals 0, product of x minus r. If f has just one root, then this greatest common divisor is exactly x minus r. And this is something computationally useful. This is a way that we can take f and easily compute p powers of x modulo f. Even if p is gigantic, subtract x from that, take a greatest common divisor, is also easy by Euclid's algorithm, and then if there's a unique root, you just see it. It's x minus r. If there's many roots, you can separate those in various ways. More generally, you can factor univariate polynomials, can factor f of x over fp into its irreducible factors, not just the linear ones, in polynomial time. And there's a lot to say about what the polynomial is, but just as an example of a wonderful mathematical pattern, here's one of the nice things that mathematicians have discovered. I suppose Legendre is responsible for a lot of this, gals. If you view this as inverting a function, you could say that, well, if you multiply together functions, polynomials over FP in one variable, that's something you can invert. You can undo multiplication in polynomial time reasonably quickly. But other examples of trying to invert multiplication are not nearly as easy. Suppose you want to factor integers. And here the patterns are not so clear. There's not as much structure to exploit. But still there's been some progress. And let me just crudely summarize that by saying that factorization of integers takes sub-exponential time. There's an exponential number of inputs, and you can find them in sub-exponential time. If you have, say, b bits in your integers or in the factors of your integers, instead of having to search through 2 to the b, some constant to the b possibilities, you only have to search through provably constant to the square root of b, something times square root of b, which scales much better than something to the b, or in fact even cube root of b conjecturally with the number field sieve, something surprisingly fast thanks to some more patterns that mathematicians have discovered. Another example would be discrete logs, that it's pretty easy to compute discrete logs, surprisingly easy, although not as easy as we'd hope for. Another example of inverting something, inverting a matrix. This is another inversion problem. Suppose you have a linear map. Solving n linear equations over a field of p elements. There are p to the n solutions. If it's n equations and n variables, none degenerate. There are p to the n possible solutions, only one of which you're looking for. But instead of taking p to the n time, you take time, let's say, n cubed, or with fancier methods, something less than n to the 2.5, maybe n to the 2.376. And maybe it's possible to do something better than that, something more like the n squared size of your linear equations, your input size. Right now, we don't have something that good, but it's fairly close. Water, thanks. One more example of an inversion problem. Suppose you move up from linear equations to quadratic equations. Then, well, suddenly it's not nearly as easy. Linear is much, much, much easier. Quadratics in some way encode any polynomial system of equations, but there's still some progress. You can solve, let's say, 2n linear equations, quadratic equations. What am I trying to say? 2n quadratic equations in n variables over a finite field. Let's say F256 as a nice challenge size. There are 256 to the n possible values of your n variables, but instead of searching through all of those, you can use fancier algorithms, Grobner basis algorithms using linearization that solve this in time. If I'm remembering correctly, something like 256 to the n, no, much smaller, 256 to the 0.3n, roughly. And that's amazingly fast. That's something where you would expect 256 to the n if you just have whatever quadratic equation. Sometimes equations are easier to solve than this, but we can handle any quadratic equations in this amount of time. Well, 2n independent quadratic equations in this amount of time, at least conjecturally. All right, if you move up to higher degree equations, then okay, it's not nearly as easy. There's all sorts of things to say about solving equations, inverting functions, finding patterns in functions more generally. And if you look at the mathematical literature, you'll get the feeling that patterns are really easy to find. Look at all these articles that are finding patterns. But the negative view of all this is that these are the easy functions. The functions being inverted here, the functions being computed, are easy. And the reason that mathematicians are successful at finding patterns is that they just give up on all the hard functions. the functions that are being inverted the functions where we're finding patterns in the outputs, hopefully enough to determine the original input, or finding any pattern at all in the output, the functions inverted here are the easy functions. Let me say big F as my name for just a general function, something you can compute, say, can you compute its inverse, or find some pattern in the output. With all due respect to mathematics, mathematicians have failed miserably at inverting most functions. These functions are the simple ones, the easy ones, the ones that attract attention because it is possible to make some progress. Say, linear equations, wow, we can say a ton, we love linearity. Or these finding roots of univariate polynomials, that's surprisingly easy over finite field, there's all this structure to it. Solving quadratic equations, well, that's a fairly generic problem and there's not a ton of progress, but there's still, because of the quadratic limitation, there's enough progress that we can say something. Integer factorization, well, all these problems and any other problem you might think of in mathematics, well, there's some amount of progress, more progress on the easy problems, which is why the easy problems attract more attention. We focus on the easy functions, f, because if you look at a typical function, f, then it has apparently, typical f, has no apparent useful structure. Conclusion from this observation about what mathematicians do is that most functions f that you might write down, the reason that people are failing at most functions f to find any useful patterns, the reason people are focusing on these simple functions is because those functions f really are indistinguishable from random. It's reasonable to conjecture, apparently, most f's are good stream ciphers, secure stream ciphers. Maybe, okay, I won't worry about speed until next moment, but let me just say secure stream ciphers. The picture that you should have in mind, a picture that's a little difficult to draw provably, but what we believe is the case, is the following. This is a picture of what? What? This is a picture of what? This is a picture of two axes. Okay, the two axes are what? They are on the vertical axis, the amount of time that you need to compute a function. This is the time to compute f. And time, well, that's maybe a vague concept, which I'll clarify the fact that it's being vague by calling it cost and begging you to ask what is the cost. Maybe it's CPU cycles or something. I'll label this arbitrarily as 0, 200, 400, 600, 800, 1,000. And of course, you can keep going. There are functions that are very, very difficult to compute. And then on the horizontal axis, I'm going to have the cost to break f in the stream cipher sense or the mathematician's sense. This is the cost to distinguish f, to find any sort of pattern in f that distinguishes it from a uniform random function with the same input and output sizes. And this, I'll use a logarithmic scale. I'll start from 2 to the 0, and then 2 to the 64, 2 to the 128, 2 to the 192, 2 to the 256, and of course that scale keeps going on forever as well. And then you can pick your favorite function f and guess where it is on this graph. Of course, both of these costs are depending on the best algorithms that you know, so either cost might be reduced if you figure out better algorithms. But you can still think, okay, I think I found the best algorithm for computing this, and I think I know the best algorithm for distinguishing it, and then you might guess that here's a function that's, say, 2 to the 256 costs to distinguish, whatever exactly cost means, and takes, say, 700, 800 cycles to compute, and so you draw a point there on the graph. And okay, it's maybe not perfectly reliable. People do find for some functions f that they move down or move to the left. You never find that things move up or to the right if you've been accurately reporting your costs, but sometimes you find better algorithms and okay, this graph is supposed to be of the minimum possible cost, which is just something that we conjecture that we know, and often we're surprised. But nevertheless, you can draw that point and then look at other functions. Maybe there's something that's lower cost to compute and lower cost to distinguish, and maybe something higher, and maybe there's something which is low cost to compute and turns out to be harder. What's my scale here? Something that's low cost to distinguish and harder to compute. I mean, something that is, say, as slow as SALSA 20 and turns out to be much easier to break. Or maybe there's things that are harder. I don't know. Maybe so you start filling in dots here. And of course, there's a ridiculously large number of computable functions. It's not uncountable. You can, in principle, keep drawing dots here and count every computable function, even enumerate algorithms for computing them. This is a picture which, after massive computer power, you might be able to draw like three dots on this picture reliably. And eventually, if you imagine spending 2 to the forever operations, then you could actually fill in more of this picture. And what it seems is that with some unclear density function, the functions f out there, there's certainly a few over to the left where they take arbitrarily large costs to compute but are very easy to distinguish, and there's apparently quite a few over to the right, and apparently a lot somewhere in the middle. This is what we think all computable functions look like. So this is a conjectured picture of all computable functions f. From, let's say, 256 bits to 1024 bits, or 256 to 512. Pick your sizes and then look at all functions f that are computable and try to draw this picture. And this is apparently, and it keeps going forever, this is apparently the picture you come up with. Now, the question of what the lower boundary there is, that's unclear. It's not clear how secure you can make something. But what is clear, what everybody believes is the case in cryptography and even outside cryptography, what everybody believes is that if you take a random function, then it's not going to be so easy to distinguish. If you make some random choice of quickly computable function, then it's not going to be way on the left side of this picture. Again, it's not clear what the density looks like, but it's very clear that when people write down functions with even a little more complexity than what mathematicians have handled before, then it's an amazing challenge for anybody to find any patterns in it. Sometimes people are a little too far down and end up with a cost to distinguish that's low. Sometimes people are aiming for the right side here and don't make it as close to the right side as they're hoping. But basically, you can take any function in this picture, and if it takes, say, 10,000 cycles to compute, then it is going to be secure. You'd have to be amazingly unlucky to pick a 10,000 cycle function, which was easy to break, which was a bad stream cipher. Stream cipher designers are aiming for the cutting edge here. They're trying to get as close to the boundary as possible, have the minimum possible speed subject to some limit on the distinguishing cost. And again, it's not clear exactly where the lower curve is there, but nevertheless, you should think that maybe hitting the edge isn't easy, but finding something that's reasonably secure is very easy. You can make all sorts of choices of f. And I want to go into a little more detail in how you build an f, and then a few things you have to watch out for, a few very rare f's that are all the way over on the left, and then a few speed issues that show up while you're doing this. So let me start with the non-controversial parts of this. what everybody agrees you should watch out for. If you're going to choose Fs, don't choose Fs that have the following very special structures. All right, what's first on my list? Let's avoid linearity. First of all, when you're computing a function, you can, of course, break down any computation into very simple operations. You could break down a computation into gates, NANDs of bits, if you like, although for practical purposes, it's better to break things down into operations that are fast, simple CPU instructions. In any case, whatever your notion of simple instructions is, it is a true fact that every computable function f is built from a chain of simple instructions. Now, if you're designing an F, you might say, okay, let's start by choosing a few instructions that I'd like because I think they're very fast, the computer supports them well, and then I'll compose them in some way. But you can't be too restrictive in your choice of instructions. For example, suppose that you build a function F by a chain of exclusive OR, popular, very fast function, where every bit is XORed with the corresponding bit positions in another word, 32 or 64 bits of data. Exclusive OR and shift and left or right and rotate. And you might think, well, those move data around quite a lot and XOR data to combine it. And, well, let's put those simple instructions together to form an F. And, well, do I have any other bad examples on my list here? Well, okay, this is good enough to give you the idea. You can pick some basic operations and then say, oops, any function f that I build from these is just doing linear operations on the bits. This is linear over z mod 2. All of the output bits are linear functions over the field of two elements of the input bits, and therefore is easy to invert. I don't care whether you can invert all the way back to the key, but it's certainly easy to distinguish. If you change one bit in the input and another bit in the input, and then try changing both bits in the input, look at four different inputs which have two bits that are differing, then the outputs will have their XORs having the same linear relation. And that's very easy to distinguish from a uniform random function, which does not have the same property. So what do? We just throw in some more operations. And, well, for salsa 20, of course, one of the basic operations there is not linear over z mod 2. Salsa 20's basic operation which until the very end where there were some additions, everything else was XORing a rotated sum if you like. You could even view the final additions as XORing a rotated sum where you take a sum of two previously computed quantities and you rotate it by zero bits and you XOR it with a zero that you have sitting around. And that gives you the sum of your quantities, which is then one of your outputs. So you start with your inputs and some constants like zeros, and then you do XOR a rotated sum repeatedly, and at the end of it, you pick some outputs as your output of salsa 20. And in general, this, well, it can simulate a NAND gate, and therefore it can compute anything. In fact, you can make a single circuit consisting of XOR a rotated sum, such that if you feed into that circuit one input specifying a computer program and another input specifying the input to that program, that circuit will compute anything. Like building a Pentium out of NAND, you could build a Pentium out of XOR a rotated sum. So this is not a bad operation the way that just, say, XOR by itself would be a bad operation. You can't build a Pentium out of just XORs. On the other hand, the particular combination of these operations in salsa 20, maybe that's not the best combination. I'm just saying the basic operation itself is not a bad selection. Now you might say, why should I use XOR and SUM and rotate? Could I choose some other operations? And the answer is sure, just avoid being linear and avoid the other little problems that I'm going to talk about. So use other operations instead. Sure, if you like, you can pick your own selection of operations. For example, the tiny encryption algorithm, which I briefly mentioned yesterday, this has as its operations same addition as in salsa 20, and same XOR as in salsa 20, 32-bit, and shift instead of rotate, left and right, shift by constant amounts. And, well, this comes first. It's one of the oldest reduced instruction set ciphers, which just uses some very simple operations. And salsa 20 owes a lot to the tiny encryption algorithm and its design. Another famous reduced instruction set cipher, something based on a surprisingly simple collection of operations, is the international data encryption algorithm, where the interesting operation is multiplication mod 2 to the 16 plus 1, which might sound like it's somehow more complicated than addition and XOR, but it's actually not such a big operation. It's something CPUs have pretty good support for, although it's maybe not making the best use of your CPU. But okay, it uses that, and it uses addition, and it uses XOR. Another famous example of a reduced instruction set cipher is the advanced encryption standard, where the interesting operation is inversion over the field of 256 elements, and then XOR and something else. So that's another operation, maybe like multiplication mod 2 to the 16 plus 1. It might look a little weird at first, and why would you want your CPU trying to compute that thing? Is there actually a CPU instruction for it? I'll get back to that issue. But that's the one of the few basic operations chosen for AES, and then AES just does a long chain of these very simple operations. The idea of a reduced instruction set cipher, like a reduced instruction set computer, is more a matter of taste, and it's a quantitative thing rather than a qualitative thing. Every cipher can be described as some composition of simple instructions. If you look at some other ciphers I won't list, then you'll find that they're combining many more operations, say 10 different operations, and hoping that that combination is more difficult to figure out than combinations of these basic operations. But any of these sets of operations can simulate any of the others. So it's perfectly reasonable to make whatever selection you want. Just don't do something like linear. Don't use just XOR, shift, and rotate. But feel free to make your own selection. If you were thinking and looking at salsa 20, hey, why use those operations? It's just for speed reasons, and I'll get back to some of the speed issues later, that I like the XOR and SUM and the combination of those, but you can use other things too, and if they're faster, great. Presumably it will be secure. All right, what else do mathematicians like seeing in functions? Well, you can have lack of diffusion, but I realize in looking at my list I should first say a little bit about 32-bit versus 64-bit. In salsa 20, I was using 32-bit operations, as most of the previous ciphers do. AES focuses on 8-bit, but can take advantage of 32-bit. I like to use 32-bit addition and XOR and rotate. Using the C notation there, well, the almost C notation of left, left, left for rotate. Because if you look around, every CPU out there does fast 32-bit additions and fast 32-bit XORs. Every CPU makes these instructions fast. And this is not just some accidental feature of CPUs. There are many other people who want to use these operations. There's a big market, just like there's a big market for multiplication, which makes all of the big CPUs support fast floating point multiplication. There's an even bigger market for 32-bit addition. It is a very popular operation in computer software, so CPUs are designed for them, so it makes sense for cryptography to take advantage of them. Now, you could say, hey, why not use 64-bit? You're getting twice as many bit operations out of a 64-bit addition or a 64-bit XOR. You're mangling twice as many bits at the same cost if you use, say, the UltraSpark 64-bit addition. And is there some problem with using 64-bit addition? And the answer is, well, it seems fine from a security perspective, but from a speed perspective, well, okay, it seems secure, and there's certainly CPUs where you can save time with 64-bit operations. I try to avoid 64-bit addition in particular because it really punishes some popular CPUs. There are some old CPUs that really just think, okay, the biggest integers you'll ever work with are 32-bit integers, and we're not going to support fast carries out of a 32-bit integer. For instance, the Pentium 4 is really remarkably bad at doing add with carry. Depending exactly which version of the Pentium 4 you're looking at, you can get amazingly slow 64-bit additions. On the other hand, if you want your Athlon 64 to run even faster, then use 64-bit operations. It's a matter of taste, and I want you to feel like, okay, from a security perspective, yeah, whatever choice you want is fine. There's nothing special about 32. If you had a CPU with 37-bit integers, then sure, use addition and XOR 37-bit integers if you like. You could similarly ask, what about 8-bit or 16-bit? And the answer there is, yeah, sure, seems secure, but also doesn't seem like there's any performance advantage of using 16-bit plus or 8-bit plus compared to using 32-bit plus. All of the 8-bit processors out there have fast carries, so you can build 32-bit additions from 8-bit additions. The people building 8-bit processors understand that people encounter integers bigger than 8 bits and need to add them quickly. All right, that brings me to diffusion issues. So something that mathematicians like in finding patterns is finding... Oh, let me pause for a question. Yeah. Why not multiply? Yeah, I've delayed the multiplication discussion until my list of controversial issues. But yes, I will talk about multiplication, and that is an interesting area where there are definitely some ciphers which will choose multiplications, but I have definite feelings against them for reasons that I'll try to explain. Everything I'm saying so far, I'm saying some issues here that are, yeah, choose whatever you like, you just want the best speed, and then there are other things where everybody agrees, well, don't make these choices because there's just no, well, from a security perspective, you definitely don't want something linear. All of the things I'm saying here are non-controversial. When I get to multiplications, there's definitely a controversy, so I've delayed that somewhat in my list of items to cover. Okay, so I was saying that for diffusion, something that lets you see patterns in functions is if you have some inputs that don't affect some outputs. If you have, say, X and Y turn into a function of X, comma, a function of X and Y, then you say, hey, wait a minute, Y didn't affect F of X. And that's a nice pattern, which sometimes takes some work to discover. And, well, certainly you want to have, for a good cipher, that every input bit has to affect every output bit. If I were to draw a graph, I've drawn many graphs before of computations of functions where you have the inputs at the top and then some instruction like add two inputs, and then you draw lines from the inputs into the plus, and then you have that plus added to something else, say, or multiplied. There has to be in that graph a chain connecting each of the inputs to each of the outputs. If you don't have this, then, well, of course, your function is easy to break. And maybe an unobvious example of that, suppose that your function, maybe the second most common mistake beyond linearity, is suppose that you have your function f, which is built from, let's see here. Suppose I use XOR, and oops, that's linear, let's throw in addition. And hey, how about multiplication? And I'll pick some size multiplication. How about mod 2 to the 32? which certainly a lot of processors have an instruction for, ignoring the question of how fast the instruction is, say 10 cycles on the Pentium 4, yikes, but well, okay, suppose you built from that, and let's also have, say, left shifts, which are multiplications by 2 to the something mod 2 to the 32, so just as a reminder, times 2 to the 7th, for example, mod 2 to the 32. And did I have anything else to toss in here? Okay, that's a reasonable list of operations. Now, this might seem like it's a good selection of operations unless you look at what happens to each of these mod 2. In mod 2, XOR is doing something that is, its output mod 2 is determined by its input mod 2. In addition, mod 2 is just the same as XOR. If you look at just the bottom bits, add and XOR are the same. Multiplication mod 2 to the 32, well, that is not linear, but it still has the feature that its bottom bit is determined just by its bottom bit of the input. And left shifts, the bottom bit of the output is always zero and is not affected by the top bit. So the bottom bit of the output are affected only by the bottom bit of the input. And that's something that you can easily detect, build a distinguisher out of this by saying, okay, suppose we change the second or third or fourth bit of the input, does that change the bottom bit of the output? And it never does, and that's a surprising feature for something that's supposed to be uniform random. So this is definitely a fatal security flaw, which we avoid by having right shifts or rotates or multiplications mod 2 to the 16 plus 1. Or, well, okay, once you know about this particular type of mistake, that it's not just linearity that you have to worry about. It's these operations are too simple because they don't have any diffusion from left to right. They don't have any diffusion from top bits to bottom bits. But it's very easy to select your operations to avoid this problem. Okay, you don't just want to have a chain in your computation graph from input bits to output bits, but you really want to have some high connectivity. The computation graph, on the side here I'll do just a little example of a computation graph. X and Y form the sum X plus Y, and then you might take a Z and do, say, an XOR of X plus Y and Z, and then you keep going in this graph. There's a little graph. The computation graph must be heavily connected. There have to be lots of paths from an input bit to an output bit. And to be precise about this, well, there's lots of formalizations of this notion. You can look up diffusion, or one of the older words, avalanche, or one of the more precise definitions is branch number, which has various parameters. There's lots of ways to express what exactly you need from the graph, but to give you a rough idea of what goes wrong with a lack of connectivity, a lack of heavy connectivity, it's very similar to what happens if you have no connection from an input bit to an output bit. Suppose that you can cut some number of edges, cut some number of bits in your graph. If you can separate some input bits from output bits by cutting, for example, 32 bits in your graph, 32 bit edges in the graph, then here's an attack. Any graph that has this structure, assuming there's a fair number of input bits separated from a fair number of output bits, here's what the attacker does. The attacker guesses that those 32 bits are all zeros, or are all some particular constant. The attacker can guess those 32 bits at a cost of 2 to the 32, try all the possibilities, or with chance 2 to the minus 32, guess what those bits are. The attacker can guess the 32 bits. And then he's back in, subject to that 2 to the 32 limitation, he's back in the every input bit failing to affect every output bit situation. Attacker can guess the 32 bits and then effectively disconnect the graph. As an example of what to watch out for, slight simplification of the SNFRU computation graph. SNFRU is one of the first software-oriented ciphers back in the very early 90s, maybe late 80s, 89 or so, articles running around the net. And SNFRU has a blatant violation of this philosophy, depending on the number of rounds in it. It's something else where you can pump up the number of rounds for better security, better connectivity of the graph. But at least the initial structure of SNFRU looked something like this. Here's an example of a very bad computation. Suppose that your input x, that you're turning into an output f of x, suppose that x has two pieces in it, which I will cleverly call x1 and x2, each of which has, let's say, 128 bits. And now suppose the bits of x1 are fed through a complicated, really tricky function. I'm just going to do an abstract graph here, but the important features are that x1 is fed through something you have no hope of figuring out, which is just involving x1. And x2 is processed by itself for a while, massively complicated computation that you have no hope of figuring out. And there's lots of links from x2 to x1, but I want to emphasize now in the middle that there's just arrows from right to left, and tons of those arrows. And then the computation with x1 continues and uses those bits influenced by x2, and the computation from x2 continues in a massively complicated way with, oops, no influence from x1, so let's have some influence of x1. Let's make sure we have every input bit affecting every output bit by having, and now here's the hardest part to see, but let me emphasize, there's one edge from somewhere after the complicated x1 processing to somewhere in the x2 processing. And let's assume that that edge carries only 32 bits of data. And I should also give a name to the output here. Let's say the f of x is f1 of x, comma, f2 of x. Suppose that there's only 32 bits moving along the arrow. If you draw your computation graph, then there's only 32 bit edges in the arrow from left to right. If only 32 bits in that left to right arrow, then suppose you make changes in x1. There's 2 to the 128 possibilities for x1, leaving x2 the same. What's the chance that f2 of, take an x1 and an x2, and I'll just pick some numbers, let's say 0, comma, well, to plug in particular numbers, I'm going beyond what you can prove, but you would guess that if you take some, say, 0, comma, 0, and compare that to f2 of some random thing, r, comma, 0, ignoring the graph for a moment, supposing that f were a uniform random function, suppose all the outputs of f were independent, uniform random outputs, then here we'd have 228-bit quantities, 2 to the minus 128 chance of equality. But for this particular graph, assuming that f has some reasonable randomness, assuming these 32 bits are reasonably random, then, well, for any particular, if you change x1, then you've only got 2 to the 32 possibilities for this influence on f2. And that makes it reasonable to conjecture that the probability here is only about 2 to the minus 32. Actually proving this for any particular function f is tricky, but, well, if you see this type of graph, it is very likely that you've got enough randomness in these bits coming from left to right that you can prove something like this. And sometimes with these types of structural properties, you can just give absolute proofs that, yes, this probability ends up being significantly different from what you would expect for a uniform random function. And then if you try saying, okay, it's not just this probability, if you try doing 2 to the 32 appropriate computations, giving names to the intermediate quantities here, then you can reliably tell that you're looking at f2, that you're looking at this function f with this particular structure instead of looking at a uniform, random, independent sequence of outputs. Okay. What I've drawn here, my little 3D example, is the computation graph of SHA-1. If you look at current cipher designs, then you see, well, okay, maybe it's unnecessary to go flying around the three-dimensional picture here, so I should probably switch to a two-dimensional graph, but, well, it's also kind of fun. Video games and cryptography. Let me do a more civilized picture of SHA-1. So here is the SHA-1 graph. And actually, let me, for a simplified example, show you MD5. Here's the MD5 graph. Now, this computation graph, the nodes in this graph, which are not explicitly highlighted, okay, now they're explicitly highlighted, the nodes in this graph are inputs. And you can see some labels in red here, like an AND is an AND of, each node is a 32-bit word, AND is simply ANDing, 32-bit words. AND NOT means you NOT the second one and AND it with the first one. The vertical bar there is an OR. X bracket 0 is one of the words of input. You can see some additions, rotated left by 7, and some constants, and, well, okay, this is the computation graph for MD5. And zooming out, get a lot of red, well, okay, zooming out, we can see that there are some very long edges here. There's tons of very long edges on the left. And in the middle, where there's short edges, there's actually a very narrow computation. If you look at the MD5 graph and you try to numerically evaluate it from any of the criteria that people have worked out, for instance, how many edges would you have to cut here? Suppose that, okay, my current graphing tool isn't doing bit pictures, but suppose you expanded each of the nodes there into 32 bits and looked at the influence of each bit on subsequent bits. How many bits would you have to cut in the graph to separate an input from an output? And the answer is actually surprisingly few, because you could get away with just cutting a few occasional edges in the middle and cutting a few of the long edges on the left and right. And, well, what I'm giving a vague intuitive summary of here is Wang's differential attack finding collisions in MD5. Which, well, it's the graphical exploration of this is something new for me, and I'm still improving my tools for zooming around the graphs and trying to quantitatively evaluate the graphs, but it's very clear that the structure here has far fewer edges that you need to cut to separate things, and also fails whatever other numerical criteria you might write down. This is really a much more loosely connected graph than, say, the SHA-1 graph, which has, you can see here, a lot fewer long edges. The paths from top to bottom are considerably shorter. There's a lot more of a mess on the right side here, although it's still, there's kind of a lot of short pieces on the left with a wider computation than an MD5, and then still kind of narrow, and a lot of what's happening is on the right with fairly long edges. And SHA-1, well, it's not looking too good. Right now there's attacks on it which are conjectured to find collisions in 2 to the 60-something operations instead of the 2 to the 80 that you would initially expect. Do I have SHA-256 here? I do. SHA-256 is kind of like a seriously pumped up SHA-1 with a lot more stuff happening on the left, making it a lot harder to cut the graph on the left. And then on the right, there's also a lot more happening, and it just quantitatively feels like a much bigger graph than the SHA-1 graph. And then as an example of something that has been around for 10 years now and is completely unbroken, here is the tiny encryption algorithm, which, okay, looks about as narrow as MD5, and it is, but it just keeps going for longer than MD5 does, and keeps going and going and going and going and going, and eventually it gets to some outputs. It's only a 64-bit block cipher using a 128-bit key, which keeps showing up again and again in the picture. Or another example of a modern design, SALSA 20, is a fairly wide graph, just bigger security goals than the tiny encryption algorithm, with a lot of connectivity. What's happening here is at each stage there's the 16-word inputs, the 4x4 matrix, which has been kind of flattened. And I don't remember if I put labels on this, but what's happening initially is some additions and then rotations, and then some rotations feed into XORs, and then in some different pattern there's column operations, then row operations, which end up producing the graph that you can see here. And it goes on and on and on. And there's no long edges, none of the short paths. Well, there are lots of long paths, which seems to keep this safe. It seems to stop differential attacks very early in the diagram. There's nothing that people have been able to do to push differential attacks farther down. There's no long edges to take advantage of. I think occasional long edges are fine, but having an insufficient number of long paths from input to output seems to be a problem. It's, of course, everything's conjectural, people's evaluation of how good functions are, but you can very easily see the flavor of the attacks on lots of functions by drawing these graphs and keeping in mind that you need to have a lot of connectivity. This picture is very, very bad, but even if you have some edges here and there that you can cut, even quite a few edges that you can cut and break connectivity, then you're in big trouble. What do the long edges mean? Well, a long edge means you have something that was computed early, which is getting reused late. And if that happens occasionally, it seems okay. In fact, even in SALSA 20, the key is used at the beginning and again at the end, and that doesn't seem to be a problem. So you could think of the top to bottom here as time. So at the beginning, all the computation graphs I've been drawing are the inputs are at the top, and then everything you compute from the inputs is coming next. Sometimes I stretch the graph further according to cycles, that there's a limit to how much you can do in parallel within one cycle, but the principle is the same, that the inputs you have at the beginning are at the top, and then what you have computed next is next, and what you've computed next is next, and what you've computed next is you keep going down vertically in the diagram, and then what you've computed after a round or so might be about here, and after two rounds might be about there, and then SALSA 20 keeps going for some ridiculous number of rounds, but, well, still faster than AEF. Well, the 3D picture was the same thing, but with more of a video game feel for it to attract people's attention to the screen. So the 3D picture is the same as the 2D picture in terms of its vertical orientation, but then tries to spread out the nodes more in two dimensions within each one dimension you see here. So far I've not succeeded in producing any more comprehensible graphs in three dimensions than in two dimensions, and I think that's a well-known old conclusion in the graph visualization research literature that you should do two-dimensional graphs, but, well, I can't help but try to do something 3D and have fun with it. Question? Do I have an AES graph? That is waiting for the bit-oriented version of my tools, because AES... Well, there is an AES visualization online, although that one still doesn't go down to the bit level. It's working on the individual bytes, and that's from 2001, and I'm blanking on who it was who did that. But it's a nice picture that you can see what happens if you make a little change in the AES input and trace it through to subsequent nodes. And if you look at short paths, you can predict what happens down short paths. What gets hard to predict is as you go further and further down paths, then it becomes less and less comprehensible what's happening inside AES. And AES has the same rough picture of it goes on and on for quite a while doing many, many operations, although it puts less emphasis on the total length of the paths and more emphasis on a complicated single operation. Inversion in a field of 256 elements maybe I should say as a function, this is inversion with zero mapping to zero, so that defines it everywhere. That has the nice property that any particular difference of inputs spreads out into all sorts of random differences of the reciprocals of the inputs. You really can't predict anything. Well, you can predict almost nothing about the reciprocals of two numbers, about the difference of reciprocals given the difference of the inputs, and that lets the AES designers prove some things about the branch number of AES. But anyway, they have some more complicated single operation and then fewer iterations of the single operation. And I think for me as a visualization project, I want to break both these designs and the AES type designs down into bit level operations so you can see without your preconceived notions of what sizes, what structures of operations are good, you can just see here is what the bits are doing. And from that perspective, I think AES has something like half the length of the SALSA 20 graph. But I haven't drawn those graphs, so I can't confidently say it. Lots of the evaluations here, if you want to pin me down on numerically what a graph should look like, then I'll find it awfully difficult to say, okay, here is a reliable predictor of all the attacks out there. I haven't done the work yet to go through the attacks that I'm interested in and say, hey, you really can see from the following chain length evaluation in the graph, you can see how far the attack is getting. But I'm hoping that something like that will be true. And certainly, it seems visually true. If you draw pictures of functions that have been attacked versus functions that have not, then you see very clear differences in the chain length, the number of edges that you can cut in order to start breaking connectivity in those graphs. Okay, so that's a diffusion picture. Let me pause for more questions. Yeah. The x-axis is trying to minimize the length of the edges. Aside from that, it doesn't have any particular meaning. All of the graphs I've been drawing in the course have been pictures where there's inputs listed in some order along the top, and then as you go on with the operations, then what's important are the edges between those inputs and the lower down intermediate results. For instance, let me go back to the MD5 graph. So in MD5, we have, for instance, here was a graph where the initial inputs come in, state bracket 2 and state bracket 1. Those are actually constants for the first block of MD5. Let me move down a bit and take some non-constant values. Here, x bracket 1 is the second word of input to MD5. And you can see a plus there, which is adding x bracket 1 and some constant in hexadecimal and adding the result of an XOR. So the plus is adding, actually it looks like there's 4 inputs that are all getting fed into the plus there, and that each operation, like that plus, takes all of the edges above it and adds all of those together, or whatever the operation is. There's now an output there, which is, well, not an output of the whole function, but just the result of that intermediate computation is the sum of all the nodes above it. And so there's the computation graph, which, again, I'd like to break these down further into the bit level so you can see exactly what is going on with the individual bits, but it's reasonably clear even from a crude glance at the graph that there's a lot less connectivity here than there is in functions that have held up quite well against cryptanalysis. Were there more questions about the graphical view? Is that provided? You mean, are these tools online? No. I still want to do the bit version, which I think will be considerably more informative, but it's putting a lot of pressure on the data structures involved in the graphical tools to avoid having the computer sit there for a minute before it draws the next picture for you. It's nice to be able to zoom around and see what's going on. However, I do hope to turn my visualization thoughts into something that people can play with. People being people other than me at some point, however not this week and probably not next week either. Okay, let me continue with, am I through my list of what you can do? I do want to emphasize that in these graphs, so I've given an example of a bad graph and shown you the MD5 graph and then for comparison the SALSA 20 graph. And you might say, hey, does SALSA 20 have to have the structure that it does where there's this 4x4 matrix and things moving around in columns and rows? And, on the computer, I did SALSA 20, which has high connectivity. And then you might ask, should you change the pattern? Can you change the pattern and still have some graph with high connectivity? And the answer is yes. There's a huge amount of flexibility. Anything you want is fine, as long as you avoid the types of mistakes that I've been talking about, as long as you avoid linearity and this lack of diffusion, then it seems just fine to do whatever you want. And the only decisions that people make about the different structures are based on speed. SALSA 20 in particular tries to achieve high parallelism, and well, at each point you can see that there are four independent operations to do. There were the four columns that are operating independently for a little while inside SALSA 20, and then the four rows that are operating independently for a little while. If you look at real CPUs, then you see that they have, on the UltraSpark, for example, two integer operations that happen at the same time. Getting a suggestion from the audience, which I will briefly ignore. CPUs offer two-way parallelism, or sometimes three-way. The UltraSpark does two integer operations each cycle. If you look at SALSA 20, it has 320 modifications of words, each modification being add, rotate, XOR. On the UltraSpark, there's no rotate instruction, so you have to break that down into a couple of shifts and an add. So it's add, shift, shift, add, XOR. Sounds like five operations times 320 is 1,600 operations, two of which happen each cycle for two-way parallelism, because SALSA 20 actually has four operations that can happen in parallel. So overall, it's something like 800 cycles for SALSA 20. And that, in fact, is the performance achieved. Three-way parallelism is achieved by, say, the Athlon. The Athlon does three integer instructions each cycle, and it does have a rotate instruction. So on the Athlon, SALSA 20 has 320 modifications, each of which is add, rotate, XOR. 320 times three operations, three-way parallelism, sounds like 320 cycles. Actually, the Athlon's not quite that fast because it only has seven usable integer registers and you have to do a lot of loads and stores, but you can still come close to three-way parallelism. And then there's even CPUs where you have four-way parallelism. Which SALSA 20 can still take advantage of. For example, the SSE3 instructions on recent Intel chips or some recent AMD chips. There are some CPUs which are willing to do four integer instructions in parallel, and those SALSA 20 takes advantage of that. If there's a market for doing more stuff in parallel, then SALSA 20 doesn't have enough built-in parallelism to take advantage of that, unless you're generating multiple SALSA 20 blocks doing multiple independent computations. So if there's a market for more than four-way parallelism, then, well, sorry, it doesn't speed up SALSA 20, and you might decide to change your cipher so that it has more parallelism, or you might decide that lower is better, and realistically, most CPUs, it's just two or three operations in parallel. And these are the kinds of choices that people make just based on, well, anything works, anything's secure, just have enough diffusion, avoid linearity, and then try to make things as fast as possible. And that's what motivated the SALSA 20 design, was subject to making it faster than AES. I tried to throw in as many rounds as possible, give people some confidence in the security, and it turns out that was massive overkill, as I was hoping at the beginning, so you could scale it down and make something reasonably fast for its security level. And there's lots of other approaches to doing this, which all have the same basic feature of trying to do lots of operations in parallel, and within each operation do, say, lots of bit operations in parallel. So SALSA 20 has lots of ways to take advantage of existing CPUs, the parallelism available in existing CPUs. You might also ask, instead of changing the parallelism, you might try making a wider computation. That's a clear difference between a lot of graphs, is that if you have an overly narrow graph, then it becomes breakable. You might ask, could we, not increase the parallelism, increase the width of the graph? instead of having just 512 bits from each level of the graph to the next level. You could have 1024, you could have more. Very popular stream cipher design idea is to have a gigantically wide graph. And that really seems to pose huge problems for the attacker. And yeah, that's a fine thing to do. It maybe even improves security. It makes attacks more difficult to have more bits flying around. Salsa 20 has only 512 bits that it's playing with. But there is one speed issue here which motivates my saying, nah, I want to stick to 512 bits, which is that even for Salsa 20, Salsa 20 already has register pressure issues, x86 register problems, which on, say, the Athlon, mean that you have to do a lot of loads and stores, and I should add that comment, that on the x86, there are lots of loads and stores, which end up being something of a bottleneck in Salsa 20. And if you have even more data to play with, if you have, say, 1024 bits that you're working with, then you're really abandoning the x86. You're forcing x86s to be doing constant loads and stores, and then focusing on say, 64-bit processors with a lot of registers, which is okay, but for Salsa 20, I wanted to make it run quickly on everything, including the old 32-bit processors. All right, so there's lots of choices you can make, which are all quite reasonable for security, and the particular choices in Salsa 20, I was just trying to make lots of implementer options, not require a lot of registers, not require a lot of loads and stores, not fail to take advantage of parallelism, and it seems to have done okay on a wide variety of processors, but again, this is something where you can make tons of different choices. There's all sorts of stream ciphers out there that do perfectly well, and I don't want you to think that Salsa 20 is somehow special. I have one more comment about non-controversial issues, and then in the meantime, I thought there was a question in the back about Salsa 20, which if I'm correctly understanding the question, then I will attempt to answer. You recall that Salsa 20 has this 4x4 matrix, which I'll briefly draw on the board here, with a kind of special diagonal, and then things are moving kind of down through the diagonal, and then wrapping around, and then moving kind of through the rows in a similar way. And people have asked me about the Salsa 20 name, which was also the current question. One interpretation of salsa is, of course, the sauce. It's sauce in Spanish, but the intended interpretation is as the dance. There are many, many ciphers that are named after vicious animals that are supposed to rip your innards apart, or after yogurt or other things that get mixed. And while Salsa 20 is the dance visualization, which Tanya was volunteering to illustrate in the back of the room. No, she says no. Oh, well. Anyway, those of you who know the Salsa 20 dance, that you're sort of standing with somebody else and then going forward and backward, and then there's various turns around, well, you might recognize something of the Salsa philosophy reflected in the Salsa 20 stream cipher design, or you might think I'm just making this up. So anyway, that's where the Salsa 20 name comes from. So my final non-controversial comment, and then I'll finish off the morning and end stream cipher discussion with the controversies, is that you should avoid other symmetries. I've said, well, don't have linearity and don't have some, say, right-to-left pattern, something that limits your diffusion. And the last comment there is to avoid other structures. As an example of this, if you look in Salsa 20, you see a very high degree of regularity in how the matrix is handled. In Salsa 20, there's a symmetry in rotating the matrix along its diagonal. If you shift the top left down towards the bottom right and wrap around the top, then everything happening to the columns and everything happening to the rows is the same, except for one thing. In Salsa 20, there's almost a matrix rotation invariant. But there's one important piece of salsa 20 which completely breaks this, which is those constants along the diagonal that are not the same if you rotate them. This is broken by the constants on the diagonal. And you could also worry about what happens if you rotate each individual word within 32 bits, which is compatible with XOR, compatible with further rotation, and almost compatible with additions. But that's not compatible with the constants. If you see some symmetry that you've put in for, say, speed into your cipher, then break the symmetry. And that's easy to do. There are ciphers that are broken by slide attacks and other similar looking for structures that should have been avoided. And those are always very easy structures to recognize. They're things put in deliberately by the designer. And then breaking the symmetry is simply a matter of sticking some constants in at a reasonable spot. And you can prove that you've broken whatever symmetry you stuck in. Similarly, you should avoid, for instance, exponentiation, which might seem like it's a slow operation. Aside from the ability to maybe prove something about it, it's not a fast, secure stream cipher design. Avoid things that are based on factorization and other heavily mathematical structures, factorization-based ciphers. There are a few people writing papers about these just because there's some interesting proofs about relating the security of these ciphers to security of some problems that mathematicians have studied, but those are the easy problems that mathematicians have studied, and these ciphers do not achieve good speed security trade-offs. And similarly for, I just put a dot, dot, dot here, for any sort of other structures that you might think of putting into your cipher, LFSR-based ciphers are based on repeated multiplication by x modulo a polynomial in x mod 2, and that repeated multiplication is a structure that has allowed algebraic attacks. And it might seem like something that is not such a bad idea for speed, but for security, you shouldn't stick structures into your stream ciphers that might make the mathematicians happy. And this is another non-controversial aspect of stream cipher design. Which brings me to the controversies. And let me start with, I've got a few items on my list here. Let me start with the multiplication issue. Controversies. One of them is whether you should use multiplication. Now, multiplication means several different things, and let me specifically ask, should you use multiplication mod 2 to the 32? Question mark. Now, my taste about this is that it's not a good idea. It's intriguing. I like multiplication, but, well, there's a big problem with multiplication, which is that it's slow compared to addition. This is certainly much slower than additions, which you can do many of per cycle, well, per your multiplication. Depending on your CPU, the fastest CPUs out there will start a multiplication mod 2 to the 32 every two cycles or maybe every cycle, but typically additions on those CPUs will happen three additions per cycle. Much slower, multiplication is much slower than addition, XOR, and other very simple operations. The people advocating multiplication fairly say in response to this, well, okay, yes, it's say three times slower on average, depending on your CPU, but you can do a lot fewer of the multiplications. Multiplication is much more scrambling your input, and so you can get away with many fewer multiplications, a much shorter graph, as long as you make your individual operations more complicated. What I don't like about this is when I try to quantify this and say, okay, how much shorter? And nobody's able to give me, I don't know, and anybody I've asked has not been able to give me a straight answer to this. It seems that multiplication does more work than addition and XOR, but I don't know how much more work. If it's, say, doing four times more cryptographic stuff, if you could get away with four times fewer rounds and your multiplication is only two or three times slower than addition, then it's a good idea. But it's not clear that you can get away with four times as few rounds. And the reason for that is that you still need long graphs. Even if you have multiplications mod 2 to the 32 seriously mixing up your 32-bit chunks, you still need to have good connectivity. You need to have long chains. And there are certainly ciphers based on multiplication which have been broken to a surprising degree, that if you reduce them to a similar number of cycles as the current generation of stream ciphers, these ciphers have multiplications, which mean they can get fewer operations done within whatever time limit, and they've been broken because of not having long enough chains from input to output. For example, reduced round versions of IDEA, the International Data Encryption Algorithm I mentioned before, has multiplications and really advertises the wonderful scrambling effect of multiplications, but it doesn't achieve enough diffusion for the amount of time it takes compared to the current crop of stream ciphers that avoid multiplication. There are still people who will go for the quoted statement, and this is not some issue where I'm confident about my answer, but well, I feel totally comfortable with addition and XOR and a very long chain of those, clearly a conservative way to design a cipher, whereas people who use multiplications end up getting into trouble. Similarly, if you pick another multiplication instruction like floating point multiplication, then, well, you have similar issues of some CPUs, your 53-bit floating point multiplication will be fast, some CPUs are happier with 64-bit, and it's still not clear how much you can shorten the graph, how much less computation, how many fewer multiplications you can do, how many cycles you can get away with thanks to the multiplication. So for me, as a conservative cipher designer, I try to stay away from multiplication. Two more operations I wanted to mention are selection and S-boxes. Before I get into that, does this answer the questions about multiplication? You could use the top half. That raises similar questions. Each multiplication instruction, there's so many multiplication instructions out there. And if you use the top half, then, yeah, that's something that the x86 provides, if you like. It's something that most CPUs provide. There's exceptional cases of CPUs where it's just not a built-in instruction. But, yeah, it's reasonable to say for typical CPUs these days, you have the high 32-bit of a product instruction. However, that instruction tends to be very slow, like on the Pentium 4, where it takes, the recent Pentium 4s have sped it up, but most Pentium 4s out there, it takes something like 10 cycles for a multiplication, an integer multiplication. Much, much faster to use floating point multiplication, but if you ask how fast is floating point multiplication, then, okay, it's usually pretty fast, but then if you try to take advantage of 64-bit floating point multiplications, you're slow on, say, the power PC. If you use 53-bit, that's pretty good on a lot of processors, and maybe that's a reasonable operation to try to use. It's something where I certainly don't mind research in the area. What scares me is the question of how few operations you can get away with. In the same time that you're spending doing a floating point multiplication, you can typically do 2, 3, or 4 integer operations. And is it really better to be doing one multiplication, which only talks to itself, and then you have to do something else that's incompatible with the multiplication. You have to move data back and forth between the floating point unit and other units. Maybe there's a way to save time and still be confident about security. But I'm scared of it. It's something where again, this is a controversial issue. Some people are very big fans of multiplication. I've certainly heard the floating point multiplication idea, and I'd be interested in seeing cipher designs based on it, just like I'm interested in seeing cipher designs based on the other operations. I think Rabbit is one of the faster stream ciphers out there, and that one uses, I think, both the high and low chunks of multiplication, which it XORs together. It's patented, but it's free for non-commercial use, and there's now a reward for anybody who can break that one. And so if you are interested in the latest generation of cipher designs from people who do like multiplications, which, again, I do, I'm just scared of using them in cipher design because I don't know how much benefit they provide compared to addition and XOR. If you want to see that, then Rabbit is a good cipher to look at. I think it's a $1,000 price. Okay, so my selection example is something else that you might try to use, which is the following. You're given 257 secrets, which I'll call x bracket 0, x bracket 1, and so on through x bracket 255, and then a secret index I. If each of the x's is, say, 32 bits, then we're looking at 256 times 32. Sounds like 8 kilobits of data, so 2 kilobytes of data. This maps to x bracket I. X bracket 0 if I is 0, plus x bracket 1 if I is 1, plus x bracket 2 if I is 2, etc. Well, the way I'm just describing it makes it sound like you have to do 256 operations, but in fact, this sounds like a much faster operation. Seems quite efficient. That's one argument for it. And another argument for it is, well, it makes x bracket I depend on a huge number of inputs. Probabilistically, if you're trying to trace through many of these operations, then the chance of x bracket 3 affecting this output is maybe small, only 1 in 256. But if you're trying to figure out, okay, what change in the x has what effect on the output, then you have only a 1 in 256 chance of predicting that. So it seems to introduce a dependency. On many inputs, very, very efficiently, on all of the x's. But the downsides to this, what scares me about it, maybe I should say the ciphers that use this include RC4, perhaps the most popular stream cipher still. Aside from AES encounter mode, people who say they're using stream ciphers tend to mean RC4. The most popular stream cipher that's not somehow built from a block cipher. There's the RU, and the PYPY is RUPY, which is every second output of RU, and there's other variations of RU, and then HC256. There's lots of ciphers that try to use this, some huge array of X's, and then doing a secret lookup in all of those secret X's, and then hopefully the output is something really hard to predict. The danger is, from a security perspective, that maybe the attacker can guess I. It's only 8 bits to guess. And if you can guess I, then suddenly you're breaking a huge number of edges in this kind of probabilistic graph. The dependency of x bracket I on all these different x's seems like that's a lot of links to break in the graph. But if the attacker guesses just I, then suddenly he's breaking all of those links except for one of the X's, determining X bracket I. This is how a lot of these ciphers have been broken. RC4 is toast. It's certainly not providing any serious level of security. RU is toast. HC256 is holding up just fine. That's another of the eStream focus ciphers, and nobody's been able to push this guessing the index idea into an actual attack on HC256. Seems very nicely designed to avoid any possibility of this happening, but I don't know how to safely do this analysis. Somehow the probabilistic nature of understanding what's going on with I is a different flavor from the types of cryptanalysis that I'm used to. But, okay, some ciphers along these lines have been broken. As a conservative designer, I try to stay away from these designs, but they're still intriguing. They seem to be very efficient for any given security level if you can avoid the disastrous attacks that break them horribly. There's one other reason that I don't like selection, which is that it creates a huge speed problem. I've just said a moment ago it's very efficient, but if you have a lot of keys and suddenly you realize, wait a minute, those X's, that's, say, a kilobyte, depending what the size of each X is, a kilobyte of data, that kilobyte is something that you have to compute from your short shared secret. It's something that you have to keep accessing. If you have a lot of keys, a lot of cache misses. Remember that a big X, big secret, is inherently slow. Which is separate from the number of bit operations that you're doing once you have X loaded into cache and you don't have many keys to deal with. A typical benchmark will just say, okay, all the X's are easily loaded in particular, X-bracket I is easily loaded, no time to wait for that, maybe two cycles to wait for the load. But you don't have to pause thinking about this X-bracket 0 through 255 and grabbing them from somewhere, and you don't count the time for pre-computing the X's. And if you ignore those in your benchmarks, which is sometimes a reasonable thing to do, as I've discussed, then you don't see this cost. But if you have a server handling lots of keys and generating lots of X's and storing them, loading them from memory, then suddenly it becomes a huge issue that you have a lot of secret data to generate your next X bracket I. Okay, one other operation I want to mention is SBox lookups, which are almost the same operation, except the X's are now public. The classic example, well, the now very popular example of a cipher that uses this is AES, where the instruction that does the F256 inversion and also some spreading that out into 32 bits, that is all encoded in a table. There's a constant table of X's, which you then do a secret lookup in. You secretly map I to X bracket I. You could compute any function this way. Just have a little table, whatever function you want, there's your function. Just look up I inside this X bracket I. Now, this is something which doesn't seem to pose any particular danger. It's something where the question of somebody guessing I, well, this doesn't feel like the type of operation that causes people to think that they're getting away with more than they actually are. If you put in enough of these transformations, like 200 table lookups in AES, then you're not going to try to reduce that thinking that you have some huge dependency of this output on lots of different inputs. X is just a constant. The only secret coming in is this 8-bit, say, value of I. And so this doesn't have the danger of suddenly collapsing down into a much simpler operation than you thought. This is clearly a very simple operation. You need a lot of these in order to build security, as AES provides. But there are some problems with it. From a speed perspective, the biggest thing that I don't like about this is that if you're doing loads, then you end up saying, okay, every cycle, for example, on the UltraSpark, I can do at most one load. Your X bracket I has to be done by a load. You really have no choice. Must be a load instruction if X is not ridiculously simple so that you can compute the same thing by arithmetic in a reasonable amount of time. If it's very simple, then okay, you're offering more possibilities like addition and XOR. You can compute anything with bit operations if you want, but for speed in AES, you really need to do loads for this X bracket I, and then the load unit turns into a bottleneck. This is an operation that if you're trying to really use it frequently, as AES does, all the security is in these transformations of I's. You have to do a lot of loads. Each of your loads is transforming only 8 bits of data. Transforms only an 8-bit I. So you need a whole lot of loads. There's no implementer choice here. Well, the other choice would be to try to compute X bracket I from I with some sequence of bit operations, but that's going to be terribly slow. What everybody does for AES is a whole bunch of loads, and those end up being the big bottleneck in AES. You have to figure out I, then do a load. You can do some loads in parallel, but the latency of figuring out your I's and waiting for your load results is the bottleneck for AES on every processor that I know, and it makes AES fairly slow compared to the current crop of stream ciphers that, at least the fastest ones, tend to avoid these loads. They'll just use loads as a way to relieve register pressure, not as a way to perform computation. All right, I have one last issue, and I'm a few minutes over time. Let me pause and think. So the last issue I wanted to mention is a criticism of both selection and SBOX lookups. I'm feeling like since this is the very last thing I want to say about stream ciphers, it's tempting to do it now. On the other hand, since it's 12:35, I am out of time. So let me follow a principle here and say, okay, this afternoon I will really, really, really finish off stream ciphers and then jump into elliptic curve Diffie-Hellman. And unless there are any quick questions at this point, then I will see. Oh, quick question. Well, as I was mentioning, two-way, we've seen in detail the UltraSpark does two integer operations per cycle. Three-way, I mentioned the Athlon has three separate integer units. And four-way, SSE3 and Altivec are the now classic examples of doing four integer operations in parallel. SSE3. Look at a Pentium 4 and you'll see four-way parallel integer instructions. Or look at an Altivec, so that's the PowerPC, G4 and beyond processors have had very fast four-way vector operations, which is also what makes SALSA 20 happen to be ridiculously fast on the PowerPC, that those instructions are surprisingly well-tuned on the PowerPC G4, making SALSA 20 do four operations every cycle, and that makes the PowerPC run SALSA 20 at surprisingly high speed. Okay, in the absence of further questions, I'll see everybody at 3:30. Oh, quick reminder for people who walked in late, we're rescheduling for next week, next Thursday, in case anybody didn't get the email and showed up late. Next Thursday, we are going to reschedule the afternoon for Friday so that people can see Dan Bonet's talk in Waterloo in the afternoon on Thursday. So Friday morning and Friday afternoon next week. This week, it's going to follow the usual schedule.